I mean, how do I describe it? It's
bold.
A light.
Black.
Unapologetically black.
Very funny, amusing.
Caring.
You give great advice from a different perspective. Passionate.
Free.
Vulnerable.
A creative.
Sexy.
My girl is lit as fuck.
Always ready to twerk a little something.
Genuine, very genuine.
Resilient.
Like, sixth sense, otherworldly. If you know, you know.
It's so vibrant, baby. Hello, 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 everyone, and welcome to So Vibrant, the place where music, history, and culture collide. I am your cultural storyteller and award-winning host, Lady AC. So first things first, we want to thank everybody so much for their engagement with last week's episode. I mean, I'm still on a high from it because if I could just tell y'all, that was a good episode, wasn't it? I mean, from the stories to the history to just the intertwined culture. I mean, shout out again to Mr. Amani Roberts for sharing his amazing work with us. And please check out his book, The Quiet Storm. I know I definitely am. But in the meantime, check out our episode, which was for last week. The Quiet Storm is named as well. So definitely, I love that, enjoyed that. So I was going on social media and came across this post that really impacted me when talking about the many different things that we're seeing going on in the world around us and honestly living through. Because at this point, every day is like, what else? Like, what else is going to happen? What else y'all going to do? But what I loved about this particular post is it was critiquing our response and our engagement with what we were seeing going on, because the influencer was making a statement about how when we are protesting, when we're fighting or pushing back, there almost is this narrative of people feeling we have to make these big grand movements of change. And the influencer was like, when did we learn that that was more valuable than the small, intimate changes that we make in our daily lives and our daily decisions? When did that weigh more than those? And it almost echoed the words of Octavia Butler for me, which a lot of people use her work now to describe what we're seeing going on. Like, the most popular one is The Parable of the Sower, which she wrote in the early 1990s, but it takes place in 2025. And as a result, a lot of people are saying, you know, she predicted the future. She was telling us, you know, what it's going to be like and everything. But even in her own words, Octavia has a rebuttal to that, basically saying that I'm not predicting the future. I'm literally just watching the habits, the engagements, and the direction that the society is going. And if we don't change the way we engage, we think, we move, we are going to head this way. And that's just where I went. And so she also speaks about the importance of when it comes to making change, when it comes to fighting back against these systems or the things that we are seeing, it doesn't take this big, huge, revolutionary thing. What really makes the change is us each collectively doing our part, doing our work, as I talked about on previous shows, and making that change effective within ourselves, within our communities, within, you know, the proximity. And those collective changes ultimately begin to affect the world around us. Those small little changes weigh just as much, are very much important to creating the change and the growth we want to see in the world. But in order to get there, and to see the importance of that, I feel we have to turn inward a little bit more and put more attention onto what literally is happening right in front of us. Because when we start to do that, we realize in the ways in which we both consciously and unconsciously actually aid and embed these same oppressive systems. And so when I was talking to my ancestors and God about it and meditating on it, all of them had one word to give me back. They was like, what you're talking about is privilege. It reminded me of a very special trip I took back in 2014 that began the reckoning of my own privilege. But before we dive into that, of course, I have to welcome you into this new information, the Soul Vibrant Way. And the way I do that is through some good music. And because I am still on a high from last week's episode, all the music today is some of my favorite R&B joints. So we're going to do this first musical break that I hope you truly enjoy. And I'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen. The East Wayne Club is proud to present tonight a most delectable treat. We have Mr. Eric Robinson. We have the illustrious Darian Brockett. Also, we got the rapper Big Pooh. All backed by Lorenzo Ferguson and the Funky Fanger Experience.
Our encounter started innocently. She spilled her drink on me. But she was fine. So I was fine. Her hands on me, wiping off this wine. I said, let's get in line so I can buy you another. Don't mean no disrespect, you might came here with another. And then she replied, well, not tonight. I said, oh, is that wrong? Well, hello then. Let me get that car door open for you.
That you ain't wanna keep me waiting. But why rush a good thing? To her is what I replied.
Can't get enough of you. Wanting my whole life with you.
But for now, let's enjoy tonight. Let's fast forward to the dance floor. You know what we came for. Baby, that's to have a good time. The mood is right.
Told me 6 more minutes, stay past, we gone. On the dance floor, stepping, leave troubles at home. On the dance floor, sweating, baby girl in the zone. Got a head cocked back, I got my hands straight like a crease in the air. Looking like an Ernie Bonds piece, not a care. A let yourself go moment that we both share. Let down your hair, let's go.
Wanna dance the night away with you. Take my hand, let's get it started, baby.
You don't have to thank me for it. Nobody's keeping scores. We can do anything you like. And baby, this could be the night. 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 Just for you.
And that was Zoe featuring Eric Robinson, Darian Brockington, and Fonte with This Could Be the Night. Gave you a nice little groove with that one. Love that joint right there. But to pivot into today's conversation about privilege, I mentioned that I took a trip back in 2014 that really opened my eyes to the way in which I viewed and enacted the concept of privilege within my daily life and engagement with the world. Because typically when we talk about the concept of privilege, we look at it from a binary kind of view of, you know, basically affording something, wealth, gaining access, or taking advantage of something. And if we are critical of it, typically I tend to see people call out things such as the concept of white privilege. And for anybody who doesn't know, white privilege is basically addressing the fact that, you know, not saying that European Americans or white people don't go through hard times or don't have any struggles, but those struggles and hard times aren't the result of their race, their class, their identity, where that is the case for marginalized communities or such as, you know, people of color, Black people, Indigenous people. I feel too much of our energy is put on critiquing them, is put on trying to change and convince them of what's going on. They don't care. They don't, you know, are not worried about that. So in a way, we're kind of wasting our breath just arguing and pushing and trying to be seen and trying to be heard by people who've made it very clear that we don't. And I feel that we need to put that same energy on critiquing and empowering us and what we need to unlearn and relearn and dismantle within ourselves, within our own norms. So that way we can be just as effective in fighting back and creating the world that we want to see. And for me, that was this very amazing study abroad I did. So the trip I took in 2014 was a study abroad trip to Tanzania in the continent of Africa, East Africa. So just to give a little information on the trip, I graduated in 2014, and the trip was that same month, and all of it just had to be aligned because, you know, basically when you study abroad, you're basically taking a class in a different country. So in order to take it, you have to be in college. So with me graduating, that posed a issue. But luckily for me, the professor who hosted the trip, who put the trip together, she had a traveling company. So since I was graduating, I went through her traveling company and was able to go on to the trip. So I got to see, you know, the same sites, got the same excursions, got to have the same experience, but without the classwork. So that all just aligned and worked in my favor, right? So the purpose of the trip, it was a psychology program, and basically to understand the emotional and the mental and physical impact that skin bleaching had on that region as a result of enslavement and the history of that in that country. Because up until this professor created the study abroad, it wasn't being talked about. It wasn't being acknowledged. And it wasn't until she started personally traveling there and seeing the involvement and seeing how prevalent it was in this area that she created a program to expose and talk about that. And as a result of that program, it made me dive into the concept of privilege. Matter of fact, I remember, so even though I didn't have to do the classwork, me and this other students I took the trip with, when we would all have dinner or lunch together, she would pose these writing prompts, because they did have to write papers, but we were all able to engage in the conversation. And the one question I remember in particular, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, I can't remember word for word, was she asked, how has your concept or your understanding of your privilege changed after engaging, attending, and being a part of this trip? It led me to look at privilege in particularly three different ways. The very first one, and the most noticeable one, of course, is the American privilege. Due to imperialism, colonialism, that this country has done worldwide and asserted itself in such this, on this world stage, as such this global power. How much influence, for lack of better words, me having that American passport gave me in that country was, when looking at it critically, was very unsettling. Meaning, to give an example, so when we went into these countries, we got to, you know, see, of course, the beautiful architecture, we got to see the many different towns, got to experience so many different excursions, restaurants, safaris, environments, places of businesses, from the street markets all the way to, I think we even went to the hotel that Obama stayed in when he came to visit East Africa that one time. And this was right after he got elected. So the energy of seeing us, everybody was constantly looking at us, especially the black students that were talking, oh, Obama, Obama. Because in their minds, because we're America, we just had that plug. We were just connected to Obama, you know. But as we start to engage with the different people that we were meeting with, from our tour guides to the people we were just visiting their homes or going through the street markets, it became very apparent, and even in that moment for me, shocking how so much of what we were doing, the people that lived there all their lives, couldn't even have done a fraction of what we done. Like, I remember, for instance, in addition to going to Tanzania, Tanzania is kind of broken up into two places. So there's the country of Tanzania, and then there's an island off the shore of it called Zanzibar. In order to get to Zanzibar, you had to take a ferry. It genuinely shocked me how many people couldn't even afford to take the ferry to get to this island that they literally live next to. Or even when we got to the island, how many people on the island of Zanzibar never left because they couldn't afford to leave it and take the ferry back into the city. When we look at what's going on in Puerto Rico and in Hawaii, and how the people of these beautiful tropical places don't even get to enjoy them because literally the tourism is pricing them out, is taking so much of their resources and really watering down their culture and their essence as a people, because this tourism is trying to cater to all these foreigners coming in. So it makes sense why, especially I know in Hawaii, why a lot of the indigenous people of that land are protesting and really claiming to people like, hey, don't come here, because when you come here, this is hurting us. But how many of us ignored, as a society, ignored those pleas, ignored those understanding, and just decided we deserve a vacation, we deserve to go there, you know, this is part of America, not realizing that horrible history of how America made these places part of them, literally through imperialism and colonization. And then also another privilege of that, just the concept of traveling is a privilege. I think if we really understood the fact of us being able to go into another country and experience their culture and experience who they are and experience how they live, and really valuing that, not just treat these places like a one-time thing where we can just have fun and enjoy ourselves and trash it and treat it any kind of way, but if we genuinely just went to appreciate, to value, that's one way we can change it. And going back to Tanzania, another way of the privilege is the concept of the history. Now, typically when people talk about, especially when it comes to Black history, and I remember I did my episode about it back for the Juneteenth, where I talked about the way we teach Black history, happens to be this narrative where a lot of the story of Black history tends to be told from the Western point of view. That's why things like, when people say things like, you know, Black history is American history, they really honestly irk me, because if you look at it from that perspective, then it makes sense why people begin our history with slavery. Because as far as our story goes in America, that's where we began, when we were enslaved. But when you look at and pull back the cover of America and you look at Black history as it is, there is so much more to that story, so much more nuance, so much more context that we don't get the full story of. I've heard people who know, who discuss history and debating it and talking about it, have said some very, in my opinion, ignorant things, such as, you know, if they were such great, you know, explorers and warriors and and kings and queens and all that, why didn't they come get us when they took us away? Why didn't they come back and fight back and do all these different things? And I feel that ignorance is born out of the fact that the whole history is not being told. After we were taken away, the damage was still being done on the continent. They were still being colonized. They were still being pillaged. They were still being taken over. They were still fighting to try to free themselves from the colonizers that came through there. And what exposed me to that was learning the history from East Africa. There's a lot of perspective, like I said, from the West, because that was one of the larger ports where a lot of enslaved Africans were taken. What a lot of people don't know, or what is not often talked about, is that that wasn't the only port. There was a port leaving every inch of that continent. I'm not just the West, but also in the South, also in the North, and what I learned on this trip in the East. When we talk about the slave trade, if we do talk about it, you know, we talk about, you know, it started in the 1600s and began all the way into the 1900s. But when I learned the East African history, or the history from Tanzania, they had history showing how there are records of slavery starting in as early as the 1400s. So imagine, that's 200 years worth of history that isn't talked about. How much of context are we missing when we don't talk about that? We don't acknowledge that. And then what was very unique about the Tanzanian history is it also showed who else was involved in the slave trade. Because in particularly in Tanzania, the first people to colonize or to invade them, to enslave them, was the country of Portugal. And also of East Asia, the Arab influence. Because I remember when we were traveling and looking and learning the history, we were seeing, I'm going to be honest with y'all, it looked like something out of Aladdin. Some parts of that country, like, it really felt like we stepped into Agrabah and we saw like the different architecture and the different sculptures, and we learned about the sultans and their concubines and the what, like all that language being used, because that's how deep that influence was. And then just the fact of acknowledging that history, displaying that history, in compared to the West, where we still kind of struggle to still talk about slavery. Like, for instance, in the state of Florida, it's being talked about how they're creating children's program and literally rewriting the definition of slavery, basically saying it wasn't that bad, or, you know, that they were indigenous servitudes, all the way into the textbooks in Texas, which rewrite slavery as enslaved people were unpaid interns. But here we are in this whole different part of the world, literally on the other side of the world, and they are very open with it. They have it plastered everywhere. They talk in depth about those connections, about the results of it. Other thing, when it came to the language, that's another thing about the history that combines the language. It was Portugal, there was Portuguese. They spoke Arabic. I think I heard Spanish, I heard French, there was a little English, but the major language of that country was Kiswahili. But when you learn the history of Kiswahili, it's a combination of what that traditional African language with Arabic, and that's how it became a thing. But imagine how, you know, if I didn't learn that history, I would have never known that. And that's why I am so big into telling all the different contexts, all the different nuances, and engaging with those things. Because when we get the full picture, we're able to make better sense of how we participate, how we are involved, how to make sense of moving forward. And honestly, in a sense, I had to check my own Americanized privilege and really appreciate where I was and who I was interacting with and what history I had the privilege of engaging with. And as a result of that, that leads me to my next privilege of pretty privilege. So for any wise traveler, you want to know exactly where you're going, you know, from their customs to their laws, to their rules, to even their social norms. What I really do love about this professor is that she made sure that we had the information to practice, learn, look up. The country itself pretty much kind of functions similar to what we consider the Muslim culture. Not necessarily conservative, but they definitely had, you know, for women, we couldn't wear our shoulders out. If we wore skirts, they had to be, you know, long, flowing, covering the knees. Honestly, the sabbat was put it to your ankles, like one of those long leaves kind of dresses or skirts. Like, I remember there were guys, you know, who had locks, so they had to tie their locks up because in certain places it wasn't seen as proper for men to have that kind of hairstyle. And so it was like a lot of different kind of changes. But what was so unique is also how still, because we are in the continent of Africa, that those traditions were also still embedded and kind of intertwined with that. And I noticed very quickly that the concept of beauty was different. Now, of course, because we're there learning about skin bleaching, we were aware of the beauty standard of colorism, you know, with light versus dark and lighter skin being more desirable and more attainable. But having that experience from America really influenced the way in the beginning how we engaged when we got to that country, only to realize that their concept of desirability was very, even though it mimicked that system that of colorism that we see here, the intentions, the nuance, the history, the context of it was very different. For example, going back to body types, where in the Western world we are plagued with things like desirability politics and such as, you know, fatophobia and thin being better, thin, able body kind of beauty standard, the European beauty standard of, you know, the blonde hair, the thin, the white, or if you are curved, you had to be a certain kind of curve with no cellulite, no stomach, you know, kind of thing. Whereas in Tanzania, they valued plus size, curvy, thick type bodies. Baby, when I walked around that country, I was turning heads and never experienced anything like that. I think at the time I was like 22 at the time. And up until that time, never had that kind of experience. I remember even joking with some of the people on the trip, like, man, I had a better dating life in these three weeks than I had in the past few years. Because literally every city we went to, every different region, there was some man there who just doted on me, that just showed his intention, gave me gifts, flirted, anything along that lines, because they genuinely just value what I look like. Like, over there, for them walking up to you and looking you in your face saying, "Oh, you so fat," is a compliment. Like, that was their version of, "Oh, hey, shawty, you looking good. What's your name? What's your number?" You know, like, that was their version of that. Like, literally, I got called fat, big, squishy, all these different names that, if I was in the West, have been, of course, in so many cases, been kind of teasing and bullying and demonizing. But in this country, those were signs of beauty. Those were signs of attraction. A funny story to tell. I remember we were going to Zanzibar. So we were on the ferry, you know, going through the check-in line and checking our bags and all that. And so there were men, of course, working the check-in line. And they were making comments in their language, in Swahili, you know, about the different girls that we were on the trip. And I remember very specifically when I came up in line, the man shut that line down and said, "Ooh, biggie, biggie." When I tell you, everybody who I was on that trip with fell out, like all of us fell out in line. Like even I couldn't help but laugh because he was just so enamored. Like he was just like, "Ooh, wee." Not just looking at me. And then I remember there was another girl who I took the trip with. She was plus size as well, but she was lighter than I was. Honey, if that was my treatment for me, they were on her times 10 because she was lighter. I remember because we were roommates and we would talk about that, like just how we were so used to, you know, the fatophobic comments, the mistreatment of us literally existing and things that we experienced. So coming here really just kind of revitalized for us to, you know, really look at us in a whole new light. And so in talking about that, I can't help but to think about the situation that just happened recently in social media, especially with Cardi B doubling down on these very fatophobic, harmful comments that she made. I'm not going to reiterate everything because, once again, I don't want to put energy into this system. But what I do want to acknowledge, the reason why it's so harmful, is that literally people of different sizes, especially a lot of plus size influencers, tried to come with her with love and really tell her, like, hey, the comments you're making, while you're claiming they're just jokes, you're claiming they're just, you know, you having a conversation with your fans, we as your fans are telling you that you're aiding in a system that is making it okay to harm and to hurt people just based on their body size. And for her to have such a visceral reaction and literally tell people to shut the hell up and all these kind of things, and double down once again, I think she recently doubled down triply about how, you know, what I get made jokes of, these are not just, you know, these were just jokes, y'all taking it, it ain't that deep, and da-da-da. Well, the truth is, it is that deep. Because that's how these subtle little things start. They start as jokes. They start as people creating ways of normalizing, treating people in dehumanizing ways. They make you bully them. They make you laugh at them. They make you other them and find them undesirable. So that way, that undesirability starts to elevate and change and morph into, well, you don't belong. You don't deserve to be here. You don't deserve to be respected. And that's how we get these systems that treat and deny people who literally are existing their humanity. They're doing that with each marginalized community that they deem unfit. But all that starts by the normalization and the little things that we do with these jokes. And so you can imagine the culture shock I had. Because the psychology of it for me, the emotional toll, really made me think about, you know, how I viewed myself, how I showed up in the world, how desirability and the worthiness depended so much on the standards that the society I lived in set. I remember coming back on the plane after having that experience. The mental toll it took knowing I was coming back to a reality where I wasn't pretty, where I wasn't desirable. I'm coming back to a country that devalues me, that doesn't see me. I go back being invisible. I go back being told I'm not worthy of existing in so many different ways. That really hit me. And I remember talking to one of the girls I was on the trip with, and she said something that really stuck with me and honestly changed my perspective of pretty privilege and even my view for myself and start to do that internal work. She said, the fact that you're able to go all the way across the country and find that feelings of beauty, find that feelings of desirability, proves that this exists. So if you can find it there, I guarantee you can find it, and you will find somebody to value you here. Because the fact that it simply exists means that it can happen. And whew, when I tell you that made me get to work, that made me really start to dive and unlearn the ways in which I had accepted fatophobia, that I started to normalize it within myself and normalize within my experience and begin to change. So that's why when, you know, you see this, such as this situation with this celebrity and with such a platform saying these things, I felt a responsibility to continue to care for myself, to continue to show up being myself, and really uplift the women who chose to engage with it and combat that. Not saying that we shouldn't, but also saying, once again, pouring in that energy and just realizing how revolutionary it is to love ourselves as a plus size, fat, bigger woman. It is to continue to show up, to continue to care for myself, regardless of how this system medically, physically, mentally treat me, and having my existence be valued in that way.
Was it a dream or was it real? When the sun came up, you disappeared. You feel like a summer breeze. Baby, close the door. It is you that I adore. Always even wanting more. For just a moment now, tell me what you're waiting for. You know what I'm waiting for. Baby, close the door. I know it won't last forever, but I just wanna feel.
Sam with Feel, and you can definitely feel that, that sultriness, that just everything about that song I love. But as I was stating, shout out to that classmate, thank you for that, which leads me to my last type of privilege, which is the privilege of perception. I think the silver lining of everything that is that we're witnessing, living through, or actively surviving or engaging with is that finally the reality of what we've been living with, what we've been dealing with, is finally being exposed. Because I really do feel like, not saying that democracy is impossible, not saying that, you know, the Constitution isn't valuable, anything like that. But I do feel that with those types of ideologies present, it creates this illusion that doesn't make us honestly connect to the events that we're witnessing and seeing until they affect us personally. Because it's interesting, and I talked about this on, you know, Talking Shit with a Purpose Part 2, of how we are starting to hear a lot of people talk about fascism, like this word fascism is everywhere. But not realizing that it's been here. But it's interesting what fascism is now that it affects certain types of people now. Like, for instance, I remember when all those protests were going on, you know, the No Kings, and they were protesting the government, all that. But I remember one sign in particular that caught my attention and my energy of what I'm talking about, this illusion, is that it read, "If Kamala won, we would be at brunch instead of protesting." And that bothered me so bad, because it showed to me how more important as a society we prefer our comforts over than the realities that plague everyone. Not saying that it would be this bad if she had won or anything like that, because the truth is we'll never really know, because, you know, it didn't happen. But how she aligned herself with a lot of the same talking points that didn't help the needs of the voting population that she was trying to win over. For instance, her biggest stance with supporting is not real, and saying they had a right to defend themselves, and that she would still continue to support them in their genocide of Palestine. That really hurt her chances, because of what they're doing in Palestine is what they're training police to do over here to us, with these different cop cities popping up, and these different, with ICE being backed, and with all these different training facilities and tactics that they're using in marginalized communities. For instance, what we're seeing in DC, they've been practicing doing this, just waiting for the moment to enact it. And now, because of who's running the country, they're able to. But all this had a foundation in really promoting fear as a way of making people to change. Because the fear that what I feel they weren't talking about was the fear of losing their comforts as a result of these systems being in place. I think a lot of us as a society didn't think, when we were saying, you know, dismantle this system, we want change, we want to break away, we want to end, you know, capitalism and imperialism, colonialism, and just the ways of that it would result in us having to check the reality of how much of what we enjoy, what we participate in, what we have access to is affected by these systems. For instance, Amazon is very popular, very accessible. A lot of people tend to use it for it, honestly, everything at this point, from groceries, deliveries, to, you know, gifts, to, you know, just spending and treating themselves. But on the other end of that, a lot of them gives money to these billionaires that hoard resources that could easily change and affect the people's lives for the better. I mean, for instance, look at just how the people at Amazon are overworked, underpaid, are treated. You know, Chris Smalls, who recently got more attention based off of his experience of how he got treated by Is Not Real when the Flotilla 2 was taken over. And how he experienced a very racial violence and abuse because of what he represents. But he also, on this side of the world, you know, unionized successfully Amazon workers against the conditions that they had. just in his example, show how intertwined these issues are and embedded. We have to get to a point where we start to break down the illusions, the comforts that we benefit from. Like, I remember I was listening to the radio, just flipping through, and this one show I happened to stop on, the guy made a joke about, you know, the Target boycott and said, man, at this point, we ain't gonna be able to go nowhere because we boycotting all these different things. And while that was a joke, we might have to start changing our perceptions of how we go about that. And I can say honestly for myself, definitely in checking my own comfort, checking my own privileges, has radically changed the way I consume, the way I shop, the way I treat myself or try to find ways to treat myself, because I also want to minimize the ways in which I personally uphold these systems and engage. And I felt if we all collectively start to do that and do that work in that way, we will start to see it hitting them where it hurts. We will start to take more of our power back and find more of a courage and to fight in the ways that we best can, that we know how. But none of that work starts until we turn and put that energy onto ourselves. It's better to use our imaginations of what can be than to succumb to the illusions that they still try to feed us. I really value and remember the amazing experience I had in Tanzania, and just hoping that even if you don't get the chance to and have the privilege of traveling, of experiencing that, when you hear this episode, it enlightens you to look at what you can do, what you can see right in front of you, what you can touch, what you can imagine, where you currently are living and how you're living, to make those small changes and see the value in work that you do. I'm gonna get off my soapbox. I'm gonna back it up and leave y'all with that. Of course, if you would like the privilege to connect with me and be in contact, I am on all social medias at facebook.com/QueenLadyAC. On Instagram and Threads, it is _IamLadyAC. On Substack, it is LadyAC. And lastly, on X and Twitter, it is IamLadyAC. All right, so until next week, y'all, please take care of yourselves. Please stop giving these folks so much of your energy. Put that energy on you. Give everybody else the overflow. All right?